Needless to say that on a rainy night like this, on the 16th of September, 20 years exactly to the date when so many of us in 1936 were sure that the great step of the Great Pyramid, which we were entering, was the advent of a new dispensation, 20 years later, we're having a man with us that really helped to formulate such a crusade. Certainly, we're very happy to welcome you here tonight. It's been a long, long time, I realize, between saucer meetings, and yet I must repeat for the benefit of those people who are new and who are here for the first time or who are here for only the second time, that our type of discovery into the field of the unidentified flying objects is far different from anything that we have ever known heretofore. You cannot find a pattern. You cannot find a tangible continuity. You cannot find or discover something in here that is so specific that you can say at last, I've got it, I know what it is, and my friends come down and look it over. 2 years ago, when we had the first Saucer Club meetings, we were so sure we had the answer. The thing was so clear, clarified, there could be no mistaking it. These were beings from other planets, high, celestial, majestic. We don't disbelieve that at all. But in the 2 years' time, all of the experiences that many of us as layman researchers have gone through, the disillusionment, and if you want the real word, a little bit of heartbreak, because you're so sure that this statement is accurate, that tape is going to be right, and that person's witness is something that you can definitely depend upon, only to find that there's somebody with a rather unconscious feel of glamorizing, of gilding the lily, of confusing mental experiences and their own imaginative subjective state with objective reality. A subject that has been called everything from crackpotism to escapism to the most profound subject to have hit this planet in 2,000 years is a thing that we have tried to find a very clear path to. It hasn't been easy. Our Detroit Flying Saucer Club can definitely, if you want to know what we stand for, it's very simple. An intelligent, aspiring look into this subject with objectivity, without any motivations, no isms, no secret religions to cultivate. We have no dues or secret rites, and we know something is happening. But we believe that saucers are part of an evolution, that they're a normal thing, that this is part of a reality, as it were. It has spiritual overtones and implications, very obviously. Many of us have been so impressed with it that it has altered our lives visibly. When I was giving a talk in Windsor about 6 months ago, a gentleman came up to me and said, Mr. Mayday, just what the saucers has done to me in making me have a new slant on life is worth all of this. I think many of us feel that way. There's been something gained, something, some great lift. When I was in my barber's chair on Saturday afternoon yesterday to the man who's supposed to be growing hair, he told me himself that if the saucers could be proven to be true, that we were visited by other planets, that the implications were so great, he said that it would change this world overnight. Well, we so agree. But it's not going to be a transition like that. And now I don't want to get in and give the talk for our speaker tonight, but I want to plant the thought that the Detroit Flying Saucer Club does stand for an attitude of mind, for a definite conviction, for a camaraderie that you cannot put down in certain statutes, covenants, and judgments. But we do believe that we have specific and definite and tangible evidences that can't be controverted. The five sightings that I've seen, three of which were unwitnessed, it made such an impression upon me that nothing changed my attitude. I've had the best meaning of religious analyses tell me, well, Henry, you know, after all, you're progressing upward and possibly you got into that psychic field and you thought you saw that flash of blue across your horizon. Well, I know all about that, too. But there wasn't any imagination. There wasn't any subjectivity. It was just as objective as this audience listening to me tonight. And several of you know that that's true in your own cases. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the man that we're bringing to you tonight has an enviable history. diamond not in the rough, with diamonds that has been roughed up, in the way that he has been able to carry a conviction through to the point that his facets have become very sharp, and to the point where he's able to give a reflection and an unbiased opinion that is almost second to none, that today, in the radio station at Indianapolis, the TV station, WTTV, he is one of the most popular newscasters in the Midwest with a waiting list to get his time. On the way back from Mountain View, Arkansas, the other afternoon, after hearing Frank Edwards at a Rotary Club luncheon in Terre Haute, I was very much impressed to listen to one of the commentators talk about this commentator, who had dared to make a very humorous swipe at our good friend Mr. Arthur Godfrey. And it caught the imagination of so many thousands of people that they guffawed for 5 minutes. That's Frank Edwards. Nonconformist, original, spontaneous. For 5 years, from 1949 to 1954, an estimated 13 million people made it a nightly ritual to wait for the news commentations of Frank Edwards. 1952, 1953, and 1954, the Motion Picture Daily poll showed that the radio and television editors of this country rated Ed Morrow, Frank Edwards, and Lowell Thomas as the nation's three top newsmen. Suddenly then in 1954, and many of you told me about this, many of you remembered the incident. Frank Edwards disappeared from the nation's airwaves. The official explanation handed out by his sponsors did not explain nor satisfy his millions of listeners, many of whom Mr. Edwards had become the last nationwide source of information on the continuing cycle of unidentified flying objects. The court of last resort that actually went on the air, stuck his neck out, and told, as many of us heard him say, a verified witness sighting in Arkansas, in Maine, in Washington, and wherever it was. On this subject, he stands alone as a veteran and prominent newsman who had the courage to tell the American public what was happening, despite the restrictions placed upon him by his sponsors. And it was Frank Edwards who caused no end of consternation to Walter Winchell and the other commentators when he scooped Donald Kehoe's Flying Saucers Are Real story before it broke in True Magazine in 1949. Ladies and gentlemen, we're so very happy tonight to bring you Frank Edwards.
You brave people.
Ladies and gentlemen, before I start my little dissertation here tonight, I'd like to explain that I'm rather hard of hearing, and I would appreciate it very much if you would applaud again a little bit louder. Thank you, Morris Jessup. I understand that I have some guests here in the audience tonight from the Intelligence Center at Dayton, Ohio. So I'm going to open my program by saying, Mr. Mady, ladies and gentlemen, and Air Force intelligence officers in civilian clothing. I hope I make it worth their while. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to make it quite plain that I'm coming here to you tonight not as a theorist, because, frankly, I have never seen a flying saucer. It's also true that I've never seen an atomic bomb, nor a hydrogen bomb, and I haven't seen an aardvark nor a platypus, but I do believe that those things exist, and that somewhere someone has seen them, and I'm willing to take their word for it, because I regard some of them as credible witnesses. The same thing holds true of the so-called flying saucers, but I should also like to say this, that I do agree with the Air Force, and you boys can take that down, I agree with the Air Force that there are no such things as flying saucers. That, unfortunately, is a slang term applied to a very distinctive type of aerial phenomena by some newspapers reporters back in 1947. I agree with the Air Force that there are no such things as flying saucers. And I also agree with the Air Force that it is much more interesting to spend millions of dollars investigating the things under their official name of unidentified flying objects. Incidentally, our nation is only one of 30 nations at the present time conducting intensive and, let me say, expensive investigations of unidentified flying objects. In a few minutes, I'm going to tell you that we have already had some results, some technological results and progress as a result of this investigation. It's been well worthwhile in at least a couple of respects, and I'll go into that in just a moment. First time I ever heard of anything that could possibly be referred to as a UFO was back in the 20s. I flew around with an old flying circus, and we flew Jennies, old JM-4s and 5s. We had 90 horsepower engines. We had so many wires on the wings that you could raise canaries in there and never lose a bird. And if you had a real good cow pasture and plenty of room, you could sometimes get into the air in half a mile. And in those days, one of the fellows that I frequently ran into was a fabled character named Bert Acosta. Bert was the fellow who said he could fly a barn door if it had enough power on it, and I believe he could have done it. There must have been times when he tried. Bert died recently. He was one of the fabled pioneers of the days of barnstorming flying. And one night, we were all sitting around in the hangar out at Denver, and we were talking, and Bert was telling an experience that he had had a month or so before, and he'd been flying somewhere down in the Southwest when he said all of a sudden he noticed about half a dozen things flying off his right wing a couple of hundred yards away, and he said they looked like manhole covers. And he told how they flew along beside him for 5 minutes or so. They had no trouble keeping up with him. In fact, they wobbled along beside him and finally turned, changed course, and flew away. He said he had never seen anything like it and had no idea what the things were, but he felt that they were very real. And none of the other flyers there, many of whom were veterans, had seen or heard of any such thing before. So the business of the flying manhole covers that Bert Acosta talked about dropped out of sight, and I never even thought about them, as a matter of fact, until June of 1947, when a story came in on the newswire to the effect that a railroad engineer in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, had reported that as he was getting off his engine in the railroad yards there, he was operating a switch engine, he happened to look up in the air and he said he saw 9 circular, shining objects flying along in a string like wild geese and flying faster, he said, than any airplane he had ever seen. Well, he got about 5 or 6 lines on the news wires, and the matter was dismissed because the editors of the news wires do not regard switch engine engineers as authorities on aerial phenomena. And they let the man have his say very briefly and forgot it. The next day, the storm broke, because the next day was the day that Kenneth Arnold of Boise, Idaho, a civilian flyer, saw the same or some similar objects, and then, as you know, that was the thing that broke the dam, because from there on, the things were seen all over the place for several months. Tens of thousands of people reported that they had witnessed such objects, which performed in unconventional manner, and the news wires were full of them. Because obviously something was going on up there, just what it was, nobody seemed to know. The Air Force immediately stepped in and said that these things were hallucinations. They couldn't have picked a worse time to make their announcement, because on the day they made their statement on July the 3rd, 1947, and on July the 4th, 1947, about 10,000 people, at least in the city of Portland, Oregon, watched these hallucinations circling around overhead and turning flips in the air. Even to this day, the Air Force maintains that the air is full of hallucinations. It has been my contention that the Air Force is full of hallucinations. Now, I'd like to make it plain, for the benefit of our guests who have come a great distance to be here, that I don't criticize the Air Force for taking the position that it might be well to keep some of the facts of this story from the public. I don't know near as much about this as the Air Force does, and I don't know anyone who does know as much about it as the Air Force does. So it's quite possible that there are some aspects of this matter which make it advisable to keep it undercover at the present time. However, I think the Air Force has been particularly stupid in the manner in which they have kept it undercover by pretending that the things don't exist when there are millions of witnesses who know better. And I happen to be one of the witnesses. I say that because I have seen some of the material in the Air Force's own files. I've seen some of their films and some of their still pictures. I've seen the notations that they had on them. And up until the night that 68 of these things appeared over Washington, D.C. in one night, in August of 1952, I had no trouble at all going to the Pentagon and going to any one of several friends that are in the Pentagon, some of them generals, and going in and being briefed on what was going on. But when 68 of these things appeared in one night over the nation's capital, and when not one single jet took off to intercept them because they were under orders not to take off, to leave these things on, when that happened, the lid went on, and the story that 68 of these things appeared over the nation's capital on that particular night was never published until I published it in a magazine story in November of 1954. If you would like to look up the record on it, you'll find it in a booklet published by the Civil Aeronautics Administration, distributed to the radar control operators of the nation for limited distribution, it says, and the title of the booklet is How to Identify and Track Unidentified Flying Objects. They're hallucinations, ladies and gentlemen, but their government's printing books about them. Well, actually, what this booklet does, it discusses a great many of these sightings around Washington, D.C., particularly those of mid-July 1952, when about a dozen of the things came over. About a dozen of them came over one night. They were tracked by radar. They were seen visually. They followed the planes in, and according to the CAA's own booklet, the pilots got good looks at the things as they followed them in and out of the airport. Some of them hovered. Some of them went around the Capitol building. Some went over the monument and the White House and over the deep freeze and circled all around there. They were seen plainly. There was no question about them being there. And as a matter of fact, the officials were so concerned about it that on the following morning they issued a shoot 'em down order. Why didn't they shoot 'em down the first night? They didn't shoot 'em down because the jets couldn't catch them, and they've never been able to catch one yet. The jets couldn't catch them. The next night they showed up. The jets didn't go up after them. They didn't go up with their shoot 'em down order for the simple reason that Albert Einstein and others of comparable standing heard about the shoot 'em down order because the story was on the front pages all over the world. They heard about the shoot 'em down order, and they personally got in touch with the little man in the White House, and I know what Mr. Einstein told him. He said, Mr. President, anyone who can cross millions of miles of space will be able to take care of himself after he gets there. Don't start something you can't finish. That was one time that Give 'em Hell Harry decided it would be better not to give 'em any hell. The order was issued that morning at 10:15. It was rescinded that afternoon at 5:30. The planes stayed on the ground that night. The objects came in. They flew in formation between the National Airport and Andrews Field, and they maneuvered around there for a couple of hours and went away. A little later, a professor named Menzel came up with a theory that all they had seen was some reflections in hot air. And I think that's as good a criticism of his theory as I can think of myself. He's been thoroughly deflated by other scientists, and the Air Force itself admitted that Dr. Menzel was off the beam a little. As a matter of fact, the conditions necessary for his theory to have proven correct did not exist that night by a wide margin. I was, as I said, able to go in there and see all these things. Had no trouble about it. I saw some of the pictures that have since been released and to which you folks have probably seen. The ones of Great Falls, Montana, the Tremont and Utah pictures, and a lot of others. I think the best still picture of one of these objects that I ever saw was the one taken by a farmer named Paul Trent at McMinnville, Oregon. He took it with a little folding
Marvin Kodak, he got two shots of the thing as it hovered over a field in back of his house just about twilight. And the structure of the object is clearly seen. It had a perfectly flat bottom. As a matter of fact, it looked pretty much like a man's sailor straw hat with a very tiny little antenna sticking out of the top of it. It's very interesting because a few nights later, it was not known that Mr. Trent had taken this picture. He didn't know what he had, and he had it developed at a drugstore. And they looked at it, he and his wife, and they couldn't figure out what the devil it was, so they let the kids play with the negatives, and they finally ended up under the couch in the front room. And the pictures were thrown around in a drawer with some other things, and it was at least a month later before anybody even knew that he had these things, and then purely by accident. But on the night of Memorial Day, 1950, an American Airlines pilot flying an EC-6 going out of the Washington National Airport en route to Tulsa was climbing over Mount Vernon, and he was then about 25 miles out of Washington. He was at an altitude of about 7,000 feet, and he said he was doing about 175 miles an hour, still climbing, when the co-pilot said, "What the devil is that?" And ahead of them, in between the clouds and themselves, they could see what he said looked like a flying submarine. He said it looked like the conning tower of a little submarine in silhouette. Suddenly, the thing sped around to the left, and he nosed the plane down and immediately called the airport and told them that he was seeing some sort of an object. And it was an unconventional thing of some sort, and they said, "Yes, we're getting a blip on it. There's something there." And he swung the plane around a little bit. He banked to the left to keep it in sight. And all of a sudden, the co-pilot said, "My God, here it is over on the right of us." So he grabbed the wheel and swung the plane back the other way. I don't know what the passengers thought about all this. And here was this object flying off their right wing, and they estimated it was about half a mile away. It circled them once. It was seen by the pilot and co-pilot, and also on the radar screen at National Airport. It circled them once and then sped away to the east and disappeared. And he reported that it looked like a conning tower of a little submarine. And, of course, it came out in the papers next day, and I have the clipping file. Now they're seeing flying submarines. Well, it sounded pretty silly until these pictures showed up some months later, which had been taken by this farmer, Paul Trent, out at McMinnville, Oregon. And there, in silhouette, was a little object that really did look like the conning tower of a small submarine when seen at that particular angle. In those days, you could, I had no trouble going over to the Pentagon and seeing these things that had come in. But after the objects came over Washington and caused so much consternation and excitement there, the silence group took over, and then I was no longer welcome at the Pentagon. When Major Kehoe's second book came out, it was called Flying Saucers from Outer Space. There was a program on the Dumont Television Network called Author Meets the Critics. And it was a program where the author went on there and became the target for a lot of very pointed and oft-times nasty criticism from various critics. And Major Kehoe's case was no exception. I was on with him. Miss Virgilia Peterson was the moderator on the program. Mr. Willie Ley, whom you just saw there in the movie, one of the founders of the V-2 rocket and the German Rocket Society, was the man who was taking the view that flying saucers and unidentified flying objects and all the rest of it were all bunk. And he was on there to debunk Major Kehoe and his book. Now, that particular program went out to 21 television stations each week. And on the night, on the week preceding the time we were to appear, they publicized the fact that Major Kehoe and Frank Edwards and Willie Ley would be on the program the following week to discuss unidentified flying objects, and in particular, to discuss critically Major Kehoe's book. The night before that particular broadcast, a few minutes past midnight, a DC-6 with 27 passengers aboard was coming out of Philadelphia. He was en route to Washington. He was about 20 or 25 minutes away from Washington. He was flying at 8,000 feet above the Conowingo Dam. He had just reported to Washington and to the Baltimore Airport that all was well. He expected to land in Washington such and such a time. He had just terminated that particular routine broadcast when both the pilot and co-pilot noticed something sliding out of a cloud bank ahead of them. And all that they saw of it was that it was a disc-shaped metallic-looking object that glinted in the moonlight. It had no wings on it, no visible means of propulsion. They were coming up on it so rapidly, they were flying at about 245 miles an hour, according to the pilot's report, and they were coming up on this thing so rapidly that the pilot was afraid of a collision, and he said to the co-pilot, flip on the wing lights. The co-pilot had already anticipated the move and had flipped the wing lights on. They'd been on about 2 seconds when this object turned a brilliant, blinding stream of white light into the cockpit. The pilot could tell that the object was coming at him at terrific speed. He thought it was a collision, and he threw this plane with its load of passengers into a steep dive, as steep as he dared to and still hold the wings. He dived 5,000 feet before he could pull the plane out of it. Now, it's most unusual to have a pilot diving a passenger plane, a four-engine passenger plane with a load of passengers. That's only done in cases of extreme emergency, and this was just such a case. He dived about 5,000 feet before he could pull out of it. He knew that there was trouble back in the cabin because the passengers were all piled up in the aisles on top of each other. The co-pilot got up and went back there. The pilot took over the ship. The object, whatever it was gone by that time. They called ahead to Washington and told them what had happened, told them to get ambulances and doctors out at the airport. The plane arrived there at a few minutes before 1. The doctors and ambulances were there, and my leg man, as we call him, my personal reporter, was also on the scene. We had arrangements made to take care of emergencies like this. He was on the scene. He had to hold his eyes open with his thumb and finger, but he was there, and he saw what went on. He had the report from me the next morning. Now, fortunately, none of these people on the plane were badly injured. A few of them were scratched up a little, and a couple of them had to have some tape on them, but they were able to proceed, and the plane was all right. It was able to proceed. But this was a very, very important case. It appeared in one issue of the Washington Post the following morning. It appeared in the first issue that came out after the incident. It was pulled out of there. It never appeared in any other newspaper or on any other program, broadcast program, except mine. That, as I said, was the night before we were to go to New York to appear on this Dumont television network. I put my program on the air with this incident in it. We went over to appear on this Dumont network program. We appeared on a network of one station. We've been cut off of everything else, although they'd advertised it, and plenty of people were listening and calling the stations and demanding to know why we weren't on. Stations were notified a few minutes before broadcast time that the network would be unable to deliver this program. And they were throwing in old Hoot Gibson movies and everything else, similar cultural level, of course. You have to maintain the level. Keyhole, Willie Lay, and I went on in New York. Well, I'll have to admit that Mr. Lay, taking the position that he did, was able to give us a pretty rough time. However, I had a letter in my pocket, which I'd received a few weeks before, from a group of the top physicists in the United States. These are men who are internationally famous for their work in the field of physics, and particularly that of nuclear physics. I had this letter in my pocket, and I was waiting for Mr. Lay. So we got about halfway through the program, and he was giving Major Keyhole a hard way to go. He kept insisting that Major Keyhole show him a piece of a flying saucer. And the Major didn't have any with him at the moment. However, I happened to have this letter. And I said to Mr. Lay, I said, Mr. Lay, I have a letter with me. I'm not permitted to read the entire letter to you, but I do have permission of the writers, of the 5 men who have signed it. I do have permission to show you the letterhead and to show you the signatures of the men who wrote it. And after I show this to you, with your permission, I would like to read just one sentence out of the letter. So I showed him the letterhead and his eyes popped open. I showed him the signatures and his jaw dropped. And I said, now, Mr. Lay, do I have your permission to read one sentence out of this? Oh, by all means, yes. So I read one sentence, and the sentence that I read was this. After 6 years of analyzing and evaluating the material on this matter furnished to us by the United States government and other sources, we, the undersigned, are of the unanimous opinion that these unidentified flying objects are interplanetary devices developed and operated by intelligent beings of a very high order. Well, it would be a magnificent understatement to say that took the wind out of Mr. Willie Lay's sails. He was on our side from there on, and we couldn't stir up any argument with him. And this Peterson had to take over as the critic because Willie was with us. He didn't want any trouble with the five guys who had signed that letter. Not only that, after the program, he got in the cab with me and rode from the Dumont Studios out to the airport out at LaGuardia, questioning me all the way on specific details in concerning these particular objects. And as you notice, Mr. Lay, who appeared on this movie actually at my personal urging, he didn't have a great deal to say. He wasn't particularly opposed to the whole idea. He was just sort of toying around with it, trying to earn his fee, and I think he did very well. I broadcast a great many of these reports. I wouldn't say a great many, but I broadcast on an average of about one a week if I considered that it was a worthwhile report from a credible source. Now, I was sponsored at that time by the American Federation of Labor. That's where my book got the title, 10 Million Sponsors. They used to say every night that I had more sponsors than any other commentator on the air. Actually, in the long history of broadcasting, I'm the only fellow who ever lost 10 million sponsors. I like to feel that they lost me. Well, at any rate, at that particular time, I was broadcasting about one a week. But being with the AFML, I had a very close working relationship with the Airline Pilots Association. And the nation's commercial airline pilots are pretty sound citizens. They have a pretty good idea of what they see, and they know just about what should be up there, and they know how to watch these things. And as you notice here, the chief pilot from Pan American Airlines, Mr. William Nash, he had done a rather methodical job of watching these things and the ones that he saw, determining, if possible, their speed, direction, and so forth, getting all the information that he could. I used to get quite a few reports from pilots, particularly, and if they were worthwhile, I tried to carry them, you know, if they were anything out of the ordinary. Pretty soon here on a tape that I have, I'm going to let you hear Captain Jack Smith of Chicago and Southern Airlines reporting by long-distance telephone to me from a thing that had just circled his plane over Stuttgart, Arkansas, about 15 minutes before he called me. I got to him before the Air Force did, in case you boys are wondering. In April of 1954, the Air Force branch in the Pentagon came out with the statement that 1954, the flying saucers had just about disappeared. They'd only had about 85 reports in the first 3 or 4 months of 54. Therefore, things must be gone. Evidently, there's nothing to them. I knew they were lying, and the word is lying, because it was a deliberate misrepresentation of facts. I personally had turned into the Air Force at the Pentagon more than 127 reports up to the time they issued that particular statement. So I had some friends in Cincinnati get in touch with Lieutenant Colonel John O'Mara, who was with the Air Technical Intelligence Center at Wright-Patterson Field. That is the place where they evaluate, they gather and evaluate all these reports. And on the same day that the Air Force in Washington said they had only 80-some reports, Lieutenant O'Mara, who evidently hadn't seen that bunch of baloney, said to my friend in the presence of a witness, "Oh," he said, "this is the heaviest year we've ever had. We're getting them at the rate of 700 a week." I put it on the air that night, and there was a great deal of official unhappiness. Now, there's been some speculation that I was fired by George Meany of the AFL because of my saucer broadcast. That happens to be a bunch of malarkey. Actually, I had the saucer broadcast occupied less than 0.5% of my time. And Mr. Meany was personally responsible for having me write an article on the so-called flying saucers, which was published in the AFL News Reporter only a few months before I severed my relationship with him. Now, the story behind the thing is this. I was the last remaining national source of information on the unidentified flying objects, which were being suppressed by official orders and with the connivance of the nation's three major news services. That was very simple to get the three major news wires to cover it up. First, the Air Force put out a statement that there was nothing to it. They'd explained everything away. Some of their explanations read like this. Could this be Venus? Was this a balloon? That's considered a solution to the thing. You answer a question with a question. Therefore, that's answered. I was the last major source. Now, they issued the statement that the things were all bunk, as they do every year. That's as regular as the one they put out, but they're building a flying saucer in Canada. That's bumped, too. But it comes out every year. It's a kind of an annual event, like Christmas. So the three major news services were notified that if they would discontinue the practice of carrying these so-called saucer sighting reports, they'd get some real good top-level stories out of the Pentagon. Of course, conversely, it was pretty obvious to the news services that if they didn't cooperate, their opponents would get the big military stories and they'd get left out. So the news services cooperated, and to this day, to a very large extent, they're still cooperating, although I noticed that the Associated Press recently jumped the gun on this case at Pixley, California, where an Air Force Convair was flying at 17,000 feet, and the pilot said it felt like we hit a brick wall, and he said that the plane was struck by an unidentified flying object. At any rate, it was so badly damaged that two of the men on it were injured. One propeller was bent, part of the tail surface was torn off. The plane fell 9,000 feet before the pilot, who was partially stunned by the impact, could get control of it and make an emergency landing. He landed, told the story to a newsman who happened to be at the Bakersfield Airport. The newsman got it on the wires. The Air Force explanation was some rivets pulled out between their ears.
Because a lot of them would have been ashamed to admit that they were attending a Governor, I spoke to the Kiwanis Club there, and at their request, I spoke on this very subject. They had 127 men present. It was the largest single meeting in the history of that Kiwanis Club. During the course of the talk, I was getting, they were very, very attentive. During the course of the talk, I said, I wonder how many of you here have seen what you consider unconventional objects in the sky in the last 3 years. Would you please hold up your hand? Out of 127, 17 members there held up their hands. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm just a reporter. I'm not a scientist. I'm trying to be an open-minded reporter. I'm trying to report the facts or what appear to be the facts as I saw them. And for that reason, I have gone through the years and I still am reporting on these unidentified flying objects as I secure what I regard as believable reports from credible witnesses. I don't know what these things are. I don't know where they come from. But I shall continue to report to the best of my ability until the time when this mystery is solved and our questions are answered. And if my suspicions are correct, this will turn out to be one of the greatest stories of all time. However, I hasten to make mention of so far, and it's just a suspicion on my part, but I certainly can't prove it.